We're talking about new efforts to respond to the missing and murdered Indigenous people crisis here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Earlier this month, the Interior Department unveiled 37 new appointments to the Not Invisible Act Commission. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, during a virtual event.
The missing and murdered Indigenous people's crisis is centuries in the making, and it will take a focused effort and time to unravel the many threads that contribute to the alarming rates.
That is courtesy of PBS NewsHour. Join in 800-642-1234. Two Wisconsinites have a seat on the commission. Kristen Welch is from the Menominee Nation, founder and executive director of the Waking Women's Healing Institute and a member of Wisconsin's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force. Kristen, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. Grace Bulltail is also here, an assistant professor at UW-Madison's Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, member of the Crow Tribe and a descendant of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara tribes of Fort Berthold, North Dakota. Grace, welcome to you.
Morning.
Good
Thank
morning.
Thank you for speaking with us.
Yes, Grace, let's start with you. Native Americans have been drawing attention to this issue of missing and murdered Indigenous people for decades now. Why hasn't more been done to address this issue?
I think that it has been a problem in our community for decades. I know that there's been movement in the recent years, I would say the past decade. And I would say that we're really taking the lead from our neighbors to the north, our relatives in Canada, who have been leading this movement. Mm. And we're starting to make the connections with what's happening in our own communities and asking for more accountability, for more action for our missing relatives.
Not just at the federal level, but at the state level. And also, as you say, you're looking to Canada that's been really working on this issue. What have you seen there in Canada?
I would say that a lot of our movements very much are influenced by what happens in Canada. I remember the Idle No More movements, which also were happening about 10 years ago. And, it very much reflects the same problems that we see in our Indigenous communities. And of course, with the boarding schools, the residential schools, a lot of that same tragic history has happened in our own country. It's starting there. It has to start somewhere, but I would say that overall Indigenous peoples are gaining more of a platform, especially with the passage of the UN Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples, that we have that venue to bring up our historic, the historic injustices, the mistreatment against our human rights that we still feel today, and that there needs to be some reckoning that needs to be addressed. And of course, our countries can do a lot more to lead those efforts.
Hmm. Kristen, you are a member of the Wisconsin Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force, and the group first met back in December of 2020. Are you seeing progress at the state level on this issue?
I think that the task force itself is making some progress. I don't know that there's been any systemic changes at the state level yet. We're nearing the end of the creation of the report, which is going to pull out some recommendations for the state. But I really still think that all of the work that's happening and the changes that are happening are coming from the grassroots and the community level, which is really our family members. It's the push and the changes coming from our family members and survivors. But we're really hopeful that with this report and the recommendations coming out in December, that the state will be able to take those mandates for change, not just recommendations, and implement them so we can see that change at the state level.
You have these subcommittees on data and on legal and family impact, indicating that this is a complex problem that cuts across many issues. Do you feel like the federal level will take this approach in breaking down this issue?
Yeah, that's what I've been seeing. We just recently had the orientation meeting, and the structure was very similar, recognizing that it's an extremely complex issue. There's many intersecting issues, and that we're going to have to sort of break it down into these smaller problems that we can address during our subcommittees.
Kristen Welch with us and Grace Bulltail. They're Wisconsinites appointed to the new federal Not Invisible Act Commission, which is tasked with addressing the problem of missing and murdered Indigenous people. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Grace, this issue touched your family personally in 2019, and my condolences for the loss of your niece, Kaysera Stops Pretty Places. What do you know about what happened to her in Montana?
Yeah, we believe that Kaysera was murdered, and we weren't notified of her death, that her body had been found. 4 days after she went missing, for 2 weeks. And then ever since then, we've had to really find out everything that we could through our own investigative efforts. The county is notorious for letting deaths go uninvestigated and ruled as undetermined or natural causes, hypothermia, accidental. And they're a really small county, and you know, they don't do much homicide investigation and don't have the capacity to do so. And you know, all of the law enforcement have been really dismissive of us in just trying to get basic information, like a police report. We had to wait months for her autopsy. And there's just a lot of things that we need answered. And, you know, we've asked the state of Montana, the Department of Justice, to step in to do something because they can, as she was found in Hardin, which is a border town off of the reservation. And you know, there should be less jurisdictional issues because it's not within tribal jurisdiction, but there's just a lack of accountability to you know, to our family, to do something about her death investigation. And, you know, we continue to see similar patterns with, unfortunately, with other women that have been missing and found murdered since then.
Kristen, I want to bring you in on this. As you hear what Grace's family has gone through, do you see similarities between what's happened with her family and what happens here in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. Within our organization, we work with a lot of families of missing and murdered, unfortunately. And every single time, it's a repeated pattern. Like Grace said, we haven't had a single case of response where it's been non-re-traumatizing by the system, where we haven't had to have advocates step in on behalf of the family or with the family to get movement on the case, whether it was the initial filing of the missing persons report. There's always seems to be a little pushback and battle, or in some cases of the murder, there's a lot of non-action or inaction or negligent action from the first initial contact all the way through to the final sentencing. So unfortunately, you know, it's a repeated pattern that we continue to see over and over again. And the families are really bearing most of that, that grief and that trauma on top of trying to fight for visibility in their family's case and to get some movement on it.
Kristen Welch and Grace Bulltail appointed to the Not Invisible Act Commission. Their charge will involve hearing testimony and crafting recommendations for the Interior and Justice Departments to address the missing and murdered Indigenous peoples crisis. Join in on this crisis, your experiences, what you want the commission to know, what you want the commission to find out. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us for a conversation on the Not Invisible Act Commission through the U.S. Department of Interior. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Nearly 40 people who will work on the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous peoples cases and human trafficking. We have two commission members with a Wisconsin connection. Join in about the Not Invisible Act and the work on the horizon, 800-642-1234. Grace Bulltail works on water resource issues and environmental justice in Indigenous communities as a faculty member of UW-Madison's Nelson Institute. Kristen Welch is here, the founder and executive director of the Waking Women's Healing Institute, a member of Wisconsin's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force, and they're here for about 9 more minutes. Kristen, you mentioned the orientation last week of what the commission members will do. How will the commission work? Can you go a little bit more into what you see on the horizon?
I think a lot of the work is definitely going to be happening within the subcommittee meetings, who are going to take those issues from the Not Invisible Act and really break them down. So over the next 18 months, that'll be our charge, is to really dive into those issues of whichever subcommittee we were hoping to be on and then placed on, and make recommendations to both the Secretary of Interior and the Attorney General. And then they can hopefully take those recommendations and make them into meaningful changes for our family members.
And Grace's work, this commission work, will involve hearing testimony, bringing people to testify. Who would you like to hear from?
I would like the commission to hold field hearings, so to go to communities that have been impacted. The county where my niece went missing and where my family is from, Bighorn County, we have the highest rates per capita of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And there should absolutely be attention put on these communities. And for the commission members and for our secretary and our attorney general to visit these communities and see what happens, to hear from the people impacted. And I hope that our families that have to share these stories, that they'll be heard, and that their stories will have meaningful impact on making changes.
Kristen, I'm wondering what that you might see as travel is involved, field work, as the group carries out its directive. Where would you like to take the commission?
We focus mostly on the Great Lakes, although we do serve all over the United States. So I would like us to focus on the Great Lakes area. There's a huge amount of human trafficking that's involved in a lot of our relatives going missing and murdered around here, but also be able to visit a lot of our urban areas. We've worked with families in LA who have had to try and navigate that huge urban setting, to Chicago, to Milwaukee. I mean, those are spaces where I think we're even more invisible than usual. So I definitely want to make sure that we're representing our urban relatives and around the Great Lakes as well.
I just, for a moment, Kristen, want to look at the size of the commission. On the Wisconsin level committee, you have 42 members at the moment. This federal committee commission has 37 members. Does the size of the working group affect what you can accomplish?
I think for this this type of a problem that's so large and has been going on for well over 500 years, you're going to need quite a few commissioner members with a wide range of experience. And really, I think that the people who have the most experience and should have the largest voice are really our family members and survivors. So I think that with a lot of organization, and it looks like this is a pretty structured commission, that the number of people isn't going to be an issue, but because of all of the intersecting issues from law enforcement to access to social determinants of health to human trafficking, you're going to have multiple perspectives on that commission for it to be effective.
Talking with Kristen Welch and Grace Bulthale, they're Wisconsinites appointed to the new federal Not Invisible Act Commission, which is working to address the problem of missing and murdered Indigenous people. You can join in 800-642-1234. Grace, will the commission address evidence of law enforcement biases, whether they be conscious or unconscious, you know, stereotypes against Indigenous people? How will the commission work on this issue?
Yeah, I think that's an important point, and I am really hopeful that that will be addressed. There are several law enforcement officials on the commission. And, you know, in our first initial meeting, you know, I said as a family member that we've had to do a lot of the work that that investigators and law enforcement should be doing. And we've had to educate ourselves and really seek resources and advocacy. And, you know, we've had to turn to organizations such as the one that Kristen runs to really help us be informed on what our rights to information are. I mean, that's definitely, I see that as a problem as far as law enforcement being biased and, you know, the narrative of victim blaming on our missing girls. And, you know, I haven't seen that specific language, but I hope that it will be addressed.
Kristen, how can people be an ally if they haven't been touched by this problem of missing and murdered Indigenous people? How can they help?
I think one way is just doing some self-education on the issues of MMIW, its history, why we got started, why it's necessary to continue and uplift this movement. But you can support family members directly. They need so much support. If you have any background in law enforcement or you're a former detective, maybe you're a prosecutor, maybe you're an advocate or mental health professional, all of these things are needed to really help support our family members. Volunteer your time with that. But there are a lot of grassroots organizations looking for helpers and volunteers and support as well. If you're interested in the legislative aspect, to get involved, making sure that you're contacting your local legislators to inform them about the issues of MMIW and that they need to be representing their constituents and making sure that we're all safe.
Grace, is there anything related to this issue that gives you hope at the moment?
Well, I just wanted to mention that the Not Invisible Act was put into motion before my niece Kaysera went missing, and it's taken several years for us to come to this point. And, you know, unfortunately we've had so many of our girls go missing and be found deceased since then. It's way overdue, and you know, we're hopeful that having a commission at this level will give us a platform, and that, you know, our voices will be heard, and we definitely want to do what we can to prevent this ongoing crisis in our communities.
Kristen, as we close here, is there a timeline for recommendations to come out from the Not Invisible Act Commission?
I believe it's about an 18-month timeline that we'll have to pull together recommendations for
for Secretary of Interior and the Attorney General.
Okay. Kristen and Grace, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Kristen Welch and Grace Bulltail, they are Wisconsinites appointed to the new federal Not Invisible Act Commission, which is tasked with addressing the problem of missing and murdered Indigenous people. Ahead this hour, we examine whether carbon offset agreements offer any real benefits for the climate. Join in with your questions about carbon credits, 800-642-1234. Stay with us. News Update is next here on the Ideas Network. About the carbon market and carbon credits, whether they really help address climate change. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to a new report from the World Bank, global carbon pricing revenue last year increased to a whopping $84 billion, around 60% higher than 2020 levels. What do you want to know about carbon credits and whether they actually reduce carbon dioxide in the atmosphere? Join in 800-642-1234. Ben Elgin covers the intersection of climate change and business for Bloomberg News. The headline from his latest piece is U.S. public forests are cashing in on dubious carbon offsets. Ben, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Good to be here.
Good morning. So you looked at carbon development agreements involving the state of Michigan, five Wisconsin counties, and this carbon development firm called Blue Source. What is notable about these carbon deals?
Well, actually, they're quite common for the carbon market. And what basically is happening is they're setting up projects where they're claiming to protect trees that otherwise would be cut down. And companies then pay credits for those trees and they get to subtract those emissions from their own ledgers. But the problem we're finding here and with many, many other projects out there is these trees are already pretty well preserved and they're not in danger of being harvested aggressively. And so it basically sets up sort of a bogus atmospheric accounting, if you will, where carbon reductions aren't really happening as claimed.
And you said in your headline that state and local governments stand to earn tens of millions of dollars for managing forests through these carbon credit schemes. Can you tell us a little more about the disconnect that you're finding?
Yeah, I mean, this is hugely tempting for these state and local governments, many of whom are very cash strapped. And basically, some of these Wisconsin counties, for instance, can earn over the next decade probably anywhere between $10 to $30 million for basically saying they're protecting these trees. And they don't have to manage their trees any differently. There's these gaping loopholes in the carbon market sort of rules that we've been looking at for the last year and a half or so. And so it's such a sort of slam dunk win for the counties in the states because, you know, without doing much differently, they get all of these funds. But the problem is obviously on the accounting side of this or the atmospheric side of this, the climate is the one that ends up holding the bag on this, right? Because if the emissions aren't actually going down or if there's not a reduction in emissions beyond what would have otherwise happened, then the accounting of this falls apart when a company buys these credits and tells the public, hey, we're carbon neutral or we've cut our emissions by half. Well, that's not actually happening, if that makes sense.
I was really surprised about when you laid it out for us that Wisconsin counties own some 2.4 million acres of forests here in Wisconsin, and which is more than 40% of all county-owned forests nationwide. So that's pretty unusual. What does that mean for how counties manage their forests in the presence of these carbon credits?
Yeah, I mean, it is a very unique forest system in Wisconsin, and that is why there's these carbon project developers, these companies are pitching counties, and they've been doing so for the last year or two, and trying to convince them, hey, enroll your forest in carbon offset projects and you can get all this money. And of course, the project developers also get some of this money, typically 20-30% or so. But yeah, so again, 2.5 million acres or so of forests in Wisconsin that are owned by these counties. And the Wisconsin counties have been pretty good stewards of their forest. They by state law, they manage their forests for a variety of different purposes. So one is timber, and it helps fund county revenues, but then they're also required to manage it for recreational purposes, as well as for wildlife protection. And so every year, these Wisconsin county forests, they grow bigger. They add more trees than they subtract through harvesting. And so, but this was going on for years and years and years. This isn't new. This isn't because of the carbon market. This is just because of these various purposes with which the Wisconsin county forest managers have to run their trees.
So what I'm hearing from you, that these carbon projects, these credits, wouldn't actually reduce timber harvest because of how timber stands have been historically managed in Wisconsin, that not much would change here.
Yeah, and this has been the big problem with carbon offset markets that we've found over our stories over the last year and a half, is carbon project developers will often seek out and look for forests that are already being managed well. And so we did a story a year ago about the Nature Conservancy, the biggest nonprofit group in the world, really, and how they were setting up all of these carbon offset projects on land that they owned. But of course, the Nature Conservancy is not going to clear cut their forests, right? And mm-hmm. they're basically saying, and what a lot of these carbon projects say is that, hey, legally we could take down a lot of these trees. And because we're not, we should be paid these carbon revenues. So that's true. But like if the Nature Conservancy or the Wisconsin County or whomever else, if they weren't going to cut these trees, yet they're selling carbon credits, it's just breaking the claims and the logic of this whole chain.
Hmm. We're talking about carbon offset deals in Wisconsin, in Michigan, and elsewhere with Ben Elgin. He's an investigative reporter for Bloomberg News. You can join in with your questions about the carbon marketplace, how it works, and at 800-642-1234. Ben, can you step back for a moment and explain the process of how carbon offset deals are put together, how this marketplace is supposed to work, and who verifies the emission reductions for carbon credits?
Yeah, well, in theory, this all should work, right? So let's say you're Delta Airlines or some big airline and you burn billions of gallons of jet fuel per year.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of alternatives in terms of reducing your emissions and just tell the world, hey, look, we're taking climate change seriously. We're cutting our impact. And so the carbon markets have sprung up to give companies sort of an alternative means to cut emissions. And they say, okay, well, look, don't cut your own emissions, but if you pay somebody else somewhere else to do this, you know, plant more trees or do something that takes CO2 out of the atmosphere, well, you get to take credit for that now. And you get to claim a lower emission. And it makes sense because the atmosphere doesn't care if a molecule of heat trapping gas came from China or Arizona or wherever. So as long as you're reducing that, it makes sense at a certain level. But there are a handful of voluntary sort of nonprofit run entities that vouch for, they set up rules for carbon projects. And one of them here in the U.S. is called the American Carbon Registry. They're run by a nonprofit. And I think everybody sort of means well, and they've tried to get this market up and running. But in doing so, they've made the bars, you know, that entities need to clear to set up projects way too lax. And so what we're seeing, as I said, I've been looking at these carbon projects for about a year and a half now and look very closely at scores of these. And it's so common right now for carbon projects to basically reward business as usual activity, right? And so it's actually some entity that's not changing their practice, but they had all these trees up for some other reason. And so, yeah, so what ends up occurring is basically it's misleading the public, because if you're an airline or you're somebody else claiming to have bought these carbon credits to slash your emissions, I mean, Delta Airlines, not to pick on them, hundreds of companies do this, but Delta's out there saying we're carbon neutral. I mean, that's an immense undertaking for an airline that burns 3 billion gallons of jet fuel a year. So they're basically saying we've removed as much CO2 as we've put into it. And it's just so important for these carbon projects to actually accomplish what they say they're doing. And unfortunately, it's falling short right now.
Let's bring on a caller. Matt is with us from Chippewa County. Hi, Matt. What would you like to bring up?
Hi, my name is Matt Hansen. I'm actually the county forest administrator in Chippewa County, and we're considering these carbon credits because they're basically paying us for the carbon that we are continuing to store and the increased carbon that we're storing over time. So as we are a third-party certified, we're FSC certified, we're actually continuing to not only maintain the carbon stores we have, but increase our carbon storage over time. And that's why we're considering these projects, because not only do they help us fund all the other things that county forests do, like he said, recreation and production of forest products, but we're also continuing to sequester more and more carbon out of the atmosphere. So I think it's a little skewed the way Ben is discussing the topic.
Matt, thank you. Ben, what do you hear out of Matt?
Yeah. And I've, you know, in the course of doing this story, I interviewed a lot of county forest managers who made the same point. And, you know, I see where Matt's coming from. And there's this idea out there that, and it makes sense. When I was doing that story in Nature Conservancy last year, there's this feeling of, gosh, we're managing these forests well. You know, we grow more trees than we cut. Like, why should we not be able to reap the benefits of these carbon markets? Like, why should they only fall to somebody who's like a rapacious harvester of their trees? And it fundamentally is not fair, right? And but the question for Matt or whomever else is setting up one of these projects, and I don't want to get too into the weeds, but all of these projects have what's called a baseline scenario. And the idea of this is to say, well, what if carbon markets did not exist at all? Like, how would the trees be managed?
Mm-hmm.
And then you're supposed to compare this baseline scenario to what's actually happening with the trees. And the delta between the two is the amount of carbon credits you get to sell. So basically, in this baseline scenario, you're saying, well, yeah, without carbon markets, the harvest would have been pretty extensive. And now without the carbon, with the carbon markets, we're going to cut less. And so that delta is supposed to be what's sold as carbon credits. It's basically saying, hey, here is the change in carbon sequestration that is occurring because of the carbon payments. Like, mm-hmm. That is what gets sold as carbon credits. So I get where Matt's coming from. It's fundamentally not fair the way carbon markets are supposed to operate. However, that's the only way this accounting works.
Bloomberg News's Ben Elgin with us reports on the carbon credit marketplace, how states are approaching it, counties approaching it. Join in on the opportunities, the risks of carbon credits, the market system for carbon trading, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Ben Elgin here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking at what the carbon credit market means for the environment and states like Wisconsin looking to generate and buy carbon credits that could offset emissions. Join in on regulation, the impact on global emissions, how this marketplace is changing and affects your community, 800-642-1234. Ben Elgin is an investigative reporter for Bloomberg News covering carbon markets and with us for about 9 more minutes. Ben, I'm wondering, are there other co-benefits that extend beyond the carbon offset project itself? And I'm thinking about a benefit to rural communities, rural counties whose budgets are otherwise very lean, and carbon credits given a boosted revenue stream for perhaps better tree health and tree management.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and so some of these ones we've looked at, Wisconsin, we're talking, you know, 10, 20, 30 million dollars over the next decade. I mean, that could be upwards of 10+% of a county's budget. And that pays for really important stuff for county services. And yeah, so it could be very, very important and a critical piece of the revenue. The problem comes in, though, is terms of like the carbon credits are supposed to cause a change in practices from what otherwise would have occurred. And unfortunately, carbon prices right now, the amount per ton that companies pay for these things, are quite low. I mean, in the U.S., they average about $4 a ton. And so there's not a lot of ways that can compete. If you're a county forest manager, you're looking at your trees, like $4 a ton isn't going to compare with what you can get for harvesting those trees. So the economics don't work out right now. Maybe if the price of carbon went up 5, 6, 7-fold, the two would become more comparable, and then county forest managers could decide, gosh, yeah, I want to cut down these trees, or maybe I'll keep them in the ground and reap the carbon benefits. Like something like that could work out for the atmosphere a bit better. But in terms of the status quo right now, unless the carbon projects are changing the way the forests are managed, the atmosphere ends up holding the bag on that.
Let's bring in Matt in Ashland, who wants to bring up greenwashing or junk credits, I believe. Matt, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I tuned in late, so I apologize if this has been covered. Very concerned about climate change, but yeah, concerned that currently these carbon markets are just greenwashing for industry like oil, gas, pipelines. Currently, you know, I can sell my forest that I'm not going to cut in Ashland County and get a credit from NCX, this private company, and then that gets sold to these industries who then say we're carbon neutral. And I guess, yeah, I see this as a potentially good idea 20 years ago that's failed utterly. And, you know, the California wildfires where all the sequestered carbon just burned up would be another example of how this seems to not maybe be working. And I'd love to hear your guests' thoughts.
Matt, thank you. Ben, is this a failing marketplace?
Unfortunately, right now it is. We see, for instance, right now, liquid natural gas being sold around the world and these shipments of LNG being billed as carbon neutral, right? Which is just quite a staggering claim. And it's so important for, you know, the credits that underpin that claim to actually be accomplishing something in the atmosphere. And the rules have been so lax so far that, you know, the public cannot be sure that these atmospheric benefits are actually occurring. You know, Matt also raised a very interesting point in terms of the wildfires. And mm-hmm. You know, carbon projects have wildfire risk buffers built into it. You know, a big forest carbon project is supposed to set aside about 20% or so of its credits to in case the thing burns up, right? It's sort of like an insurance pool. But those insurance risks were set up years and years ago. And so the wildfire situation has gotten so much worse out in California and elsewhere that these insurance pools are unlikely to keep up with the amount of wildfires we're seeing. So we're going to start, we're going to start seeing, as Matt said, a lot of carbon projects go up in smoke, unfortunately.
That hits exactly on a question from John in Appleton, who asks, you know, what if the tree stand dies? What happens to the carbon offset and that project agreement?
Yeah, I mean, the way it's supposed to work is with this buffer pool, this insurance pool. It's this this pooled risk thing. So like if one project goes up in smoke, OK, well, they'll pull credits from this pool from a lot of different projects to sort of manage that risk. Mm-hmm. But the pool has to be big and robust enough to handle the amount of risk that is potentially coming. And there's been some academics who have looked at this recently and found that, whoa, these insurance pools could be woefully understocked with what we're likely to see, unfortunately, in the next decade or so.
talking about carbon offset projects aimed at helping the environment with Bloomberg investigative reporter Ben Elgin joining us. You can join in the conversation on carbon offsets, 800-642-1234. Ben, how could there be improved transparency and improved rules in an unregulated kind of carbon offset marketplace? How could this be reformed?
Yeah, and there's groups out there within the offsets industry trying to reform this, trying to come up with way more rigorous standards. There's still works in progress, and who knows what's going to come out. We're watching it really closely. Who knows really what's going to come out of it over the next year or two? But I think there's a couple of things that could happen. I mean, one is there has to be way more transparency in terms of like how historically have forests been managed. It should include everything like harvest levels and whatnot, so then you can compare what that forward trajectory looks like, right? And if it's just a continuation of existing business practices, well, that's not going to do much probably to help the climate. Practices going forward have to be way better in terms of carbon sequestration than what's occurred in the past. I think there should be more transparency around the funds and how they flow to the beneficiaries. Right now, particularly with international carbon offset projects, there's a lot of brokers and middlemen. And sometimes it's hard to, like, if you're a company paying for an offset credit, let's say you say pay $10 a ton. Mm-hmm. How much of that flows to the actual local indigenous community on the ground in the Amazon, for instance? And that picture right now is so opaque. Nobody really knows how much really flows through and how much each person along the chain takes. And so it's so important for the benefits of these projects to flow to the landowner, to the local community. And so there has to be way more transparency, I think, in the actual flow of the financials.
As we close here, just a few seconds left, but turning this back to Wisconsin, you found Bayfield, Rusk, Iron, Washburn, and Price counties had signed deals with Blue Source to set up these carbon projects. We just heard from Chippewa County and Matt looking at it. Do you think more counties will start inking contracts here?
I do think so. Yeah. We found that there's at least a dozen more counties looking very, very closely at this. And so, as I said earlier, I think there's not much for them to lose on the way the market is currently set up. They don't really have to change much in terms of how they manage the trees, and they get this nice revenue flow. Who knows if the rules tighten up here in the next couple of years, it might mandate that the landowner would change or improve their practices above and beyond what they're already doing. But right now that doesn't occur. So I think we're going to see a lot of states, a lot of counties, a lot of even municipalities around the country start to jump into this market.
Ben, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Kate.
Ben Elgin is an investigative reporter for Bloomberg News. We have a link to his latest piece on carbon credits and state and local governments. It's at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, we talk with a gardening author, horticulturist, about how you can grow your favorite fruit or vegetables from kitchen scraps. Join in on Kitchen Scraps, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.